Earn your JD from UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law and join the powerhouse in legal education. Now accepting applications. A top 100 law school ranked 5th for intellectual property law. Apply today at law.unh.edu. With the worldwide spreading of the coronavirus, Professor Lucy Hodder discusses the response states can take to contain disease outbreaks. This is the UNH Law Podcast. Learn more about the law school and apply by visiting law.unh.edu. Opinions discussed are solely the opinion of the faculty or host and do not constitute legal advice or necessarily represent the official views of the University of New Hampshire. So, Lucy, there must be a big difference between the roles that the federal government can take versus the states.
Absolutely, and that's the question. Who can do what in the face of a natural disaster such as this, which is the spread of a very communicable disease? And that's a very interesting question. And you see lots of discussion on the news about what the federal government can do, what the state government can do, what the municipalities can and can't do, what the school districts should be doing. Yeah. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how those laws are structured and where the power comes from to be able to do something to contain people, to spend dollars, to change the rules, to tell you you can and can't go places, and to require vaccinations, et cetera. That kind of power, where does that come from? Who can do what?
And there's a tremendous difference, obviously, between, I mean, with China when it first started, with they're an entirely authoritarian state. Everything comes down from above. The leader of the country just tells, we're just going to completely lock down Wuhan and just go from there. It is not how that works in the United States.
Absolutely. And let me just say, first of all, if you want to find out the absolute most current information about the spread of coronavirus and what is happening, go to the CDC website. The World Health Organization is talking about it worldwide. Our Centers for Disease Control is issuing the most up-to-date information available. Our Department in New Hampshire of Health and Human Services is issuing releases and updates regarding the coronavirus and what to do. So go to those sources. I'm not going to tell you right here and now what our risk is of coronavirus and what you should do about it. What I want to talk a little bit about is what's the federal government's responsibility. Yeah. So let's start there. The 10th Amendment of the United States Constitution really reserves to the states any power that is not reserved to the federal government. And for a very long time, that 10th Amendment has been read to mean that states retain their own police power. So they have the power to regulate the safety and health of their own populations. And there was a case actually out of Massachusetts in 1905 when the state of Massachusetts wanted to penalize people who would not get the smallpox vaccine. And Mr. Jacobson challenged that authority and said, you can't penalize me if I don't get the vaccine. And the court said, you bet we can. The state has the enforcement power to protect the health of the public, and that is the police power, and the states can do a lot, especially with the spread of infectious disease.
And that'd be especially relevant nowadays where there's so many more people than there were 115 years ago, and there's so much more commerce and travel between states and countries.
Absolutely. And so those line of cases protecting the state's police power have continued so that in Zucht v. King, it was found that the state could require immunizations of children before they attended public school. So the case law protecting the state's ability to engage the police power to protect against the spread of infectious disease is longstanding. Let's then go back to what can the federal government do? Well, the federal government has a couple powers. First of all, the Public Health Act, Section 361, actually allows the federal government to help prevent the communicable diseases from foreign countries or from state to state. So the federal government has really said, we've got to keep as much authority as we can to prevent communicable diseases from coming into the United States. So they exercise their police power in that fashion and to prevent it from crossing borders. But the states retain the authority within their own state. So if somebody's going to tell you, you might have a communicable disease and we're going to prevent you from leaving your house, that's a state power. And let's talk a little bit about how that might be done.
Yeah, definitely.
So the Let's look at New Hampshire as a little bit of an example, because New Hampshire, I'm really proud of how New Hampshire has managed to use the resources that it could from the federal government to get ready. Because using your police power to protect the safety of your citizens requires a lot of organization. So first of all, there's a couple laws. The state has several laws that, first of all, allows the governor to declare a state of emergency. And that state of emergency can only be declared for 21 days, and then it needs to be renewed. But it's really if there's a disaster of major proportions is imminent and it, or it's occurred within the state and the safety and welfare of the inhabitants of the state require direct intervention. And then the governor can declare a state of emergency and does it by executive order. And that has to describe what the problem is and describe what powers the governor is going to use and how long it might remain. And that power can be used for anything from a flood to a issue of a communicable disease. We have not issued a state of emergency yet in New Hampshire around the coronavirus, but there has been in other locations. For example, San Francisco has issued a state of emergency. And other counties in California have issued state of emergencies. Why? Because then they get special powers to restrain people and to enforce laws and to spend dollars and to require mutual aid with other municipalities. And so, for example, that's what gives government the authority to say, you can't leave your house.
And this is especially important with a disease like coronavirus, where it could take 14 days of you being contagious before you even start showing symptoms.
Exactly. And that's, you know, the CDC is collecting information about travelers, giving it to the states. The states are calling people up, things that we wouldn't consider necessarily synonymous with our rights to due process and freedom of movement under an emergency power doctrine. When a public health and public safety is at risk, the courts have routinely confirmed that the states have the power, which of course they've now all put into law, that says they can do certain things you wouldn't otherwise expect when they've declared a state of emergency. And that goes in New Hampshire, as in many other states, that state of emergency gives different government actors authority to do different things depending on that conditions. So, for example, in New Hampshire, the Department of Health and Human Services has a lot of power to get information about communicable diseases, to even develop and spend on prevention strategies, to immunize people, etc. So, depending on the type of emergencies, there are a lot of public health powers as well.
Awesome. So, I'd imagine this varies a lot from state to state. New Hampshire, is New Hampshire different in some ways compared to other states?
No. Well, the one place that New Hampshire may be a little different is that after 9/11, there was a real effort to try and take the lessons learned from that natural disaster and use the federal tax and spend for the General Welfare Authority to really incentivize the states to get a much better command and control organization going around natural disasters. And so New Hampshire really took advantage of that and developed the Homeland Security and Emergency Management Division in the Department of Safety. And they, in fact, have an emergency operations center. And every single municipality and sub-municipality, districts, et cetera, have entered into or should have entered into mutual aid agreements that basically say, when the governor activates emergency management system and the governor opens the emergency management center, then there's a command and control around organization and response of every municipality and actor in state government and local government to respond to whatever disasters at stake. And it's a really phenomenal tool, and New Hampshire's done an incredible job to have sort of a command and control center to respond to a natural disaster.
It's fascinating to think of it this way. I'd imagine most people don't think of it this way, that there really isn't that much of a difference when it comes to a large-scale weather disaster versus a disease outbreak. Transportation stops. shops, stores aren't able to keep stocked up. People are stuck at home. They're not able to necessarily get the medicine they may need, things like that. So it's surprising to think of it that way.
Exactly. And think about it this way as well, which is it's all about organizing.
Yeah.
And it's all about how good your organization is. And if you look, New Hampshire, every single municipality has had to develop an emergency response plan. And it's all within that command and control center so that they know who to communicate with, how to communicate, where they're going to get their orders from, and where they're going to leverage resources. So that's a big part of it, the mutual aid part, so that their governor can actually have the authority to call on other governments within the state to respond to the natural disaster. And that's a critical, critical piece because if you don't have that kind of command and control and commitment to use your resources, no matter what they are, then it's not going to work and the organization isn't going to be there to respond.
And I imagine a piece of that would be law enforcement within the individual towns and cities. So they're going to need the local police to have a certain role, I'd assume.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting. Actually, the Journal of Health and Life Sciences Law, which February 2020 from the American Health Lawyers Association, which I'm actually an editor of, just did a big overview of immunization laws and different authorities of the federal and state governments. And one of the things that's very interesting is just how much organization matters in really figuring out where the federal government can do what they need to do and where the state government needs to do what they need to do. And think about it, communicable disease, it's incredibly private. So the fact that you might have coronavirus could mean that you're stuck somewhere and you can't leave for however long to prevent transmission. I just want to say that this doesn't go off without a rub. So already in California, there have been lawsuits filed to prevent the county government from using one location to keep people separate from the rest of society. They don't want their municipal center used as the location where people should go.
GY.
Yeah. So they had to declare a state of emergency in order to counter that and get the power. So there's certainly a lot of back and forth because what you're doing is you're interfering with people's rights, individual rights become subordinate to the community's need to be safe.
No, a small piece of this that you mentioned earlier were schools. I mean, what authority do schools have when it comes to this?
So schools are part of school districts, which are municipal governed bodies. So they're part of the whole mutual aid organization in New Hampshire, and presumably in other states they are as well. Now, New Hampshire's took even one further step. So there's also, as you know, the Federal Public Health Act, which really incentivizes states to deal with public health, immunizations, health and wellness, et cetera. So the feds use a lot of their money power to get states to get organized around issues that they think are important on public health. And New Hampshire has done just that. And New Hampshire actually consolidated all of its regional public health networks to be organized in a much clearer fashion in 2015. So they are all working together and report to the Department of Public Health. Division of Public Health within the Department of Health and Human Services. And so those regional public health networks also feed into that command and control center if the emergency management is activated by the governor.
What else am I missing, Lucy?
I think that's it. I think what we're missing is just what's going to happen with coronavirus. So I would have to say New Hampshire's ready, but only because it has established and worked on and tried, you know, year after year after year with different types of emergencies, how to activate the command and control and get all the different parts of government working together so that people, no matter what town they live in, how remote in New Hampshire, know what to do and we're able to work together to do it. And that is really what it takes. So some of the hysteria you're hearing about the lack of organization is that, you know, I think there's an assumption at the federal level because there's some positions that haven't been filled and there hasn't been funding, that constant effort to organize around a potential natural disaster hasn't been happening. And so people are sort of back on their heels. So we'll see what happens.
Thanks for listening to the UNH Law Podcast. Be sure to comment and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Spotify. See you next Thursday. Join the powerhouse for legal education. Earn your JD, LLM, master's degree, or certificate from a top 100 law school. Residential and online programs available, now accepting applications at law.unh.edu.